If you have a Bible, I'm going to ask you to join with me in turning to John chapter 13. A little teary-eyed there, so. Losing a partner in crime, so. John chapter 13. As you're turning there, I want to ask you a question. And here's the question. It's kind of an odd question, but I want you to think about this question. The question is this. What's been a disruptive moment in your life recently? What's been a disruptive moment in your life recently? Here's what I mean by that question. A disruptive moment, it's one of those moments that shakes up the status quo. I mean, for the Dixons, this is a disruptive moment, right? I mean, the truck is leaving this afternoon, and they're going to be in Nashville tomorrow, and it's the journey of relocating. Some of you have done that. You've got to build new relationships and start over in a new position, a new community, learn where the doctor is, where the grocery store is, and all of these things that shake up your routine and your status quo. Now, disruptive moments aren't always that dramatic, but they do shake us up in some form or fashion. So, for instance, you know, maybe you're a student, and this year you started, you changed schools. You went from middle school to high school, and with that came learning a new building and perhaps meeting new people and new teachers, and you had to kind of adjust. It was a change. There was a disruption to the normal flow for you. For others of us, you know, it can be a change in terms of job or location. Disruptive moments can include changes in relationships. Maybe you've started dating someone recently, and you know, so that's kind of shaking things up. It can entail getting married or maybe having kids. I was at the hospital yesterday, and I got onto the elevator, and this, you know, young man gets onto the elevator, and he's wearing a hospital ID bracelet. And of course, I quickly realize he's healthy. He's not a patient. He's a new dad. So I just look at him and I smile and I go, "New baby, huh?" And his face said it all. Yeah. Right? And just the expression on his face, you felt the weight and the excitement, but the reality of change. Here's a guy whose life had just been disrupted in a very positive and meaningful way. And it just his countenance communicated that. So I could just feel that. So I got out the elevator. Congratulations. I said, "I hope you get some rest tonight." And and I was on my way. But these are those kinds of moments that kind of shake us and pull us out of our normal routine and our status quo. They are disruptive moments. They can even come in the form, not just of major life change, they can come in the form of conversations. Conversations that kind of include an aha moment where you learn something about yourself or some person who's close to you, and it causes you to think about life differently or to engage certain things differently. These are disruptive moments. So has there been a disruptive moment in your life recently, and what does it look like? This morning, we are continuing our series entitled Live, Love, Lead. If you haven't been a part of this so far, we're looking at what it means to follow Jesus Christ. What does this lifestyle of a disciple look like? And as we kind of work through that issue, we've defined it simply in these terms, that a disciple is someone who lives with Jesus, loves like Jesus, and leads others to do the same. And we're really seeking to build this way of life into our church community, into our DNA as we live out our core values. So in the course of this series, we're talking about kind of discipleship from each of these three angles and what that entails. We've talked some about living with Jesus. Now we're talking about loving like Jesus. And to grab hold of that this morning, we're going to look at a very interesting moment involving Jesus and his disciples. And among other things, it is a disruptive moment. It is a moment in which I think Jesus intentionally disrupts the life experience of these people who are following him so that they can kind of come to a clear understanding of who he is, what he's about, and what it looks like to live as part of his moment. It is a place where Jesus disrupts the status quo. And just over a few minutes, here's what I want to invite you to do. I want us to just kind of step into the story together. As Jesus disrupts this life experience. Now we come to John chapter 13, and it is a scene where Jesus is gathered with his disciples. It is Passover season, and they're about to eat that meal together. And as we're going to see, if you're familiar with the story, as John tells it in this scene, what is surprising is the fact that in the course of the evening, Jesus actually washes the feet of his disciples. And as John begins to recount the story, notice how the opening of chapter 13 unfolds. Chapter 13, verse 1. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the very end, or to the uttermost. As John introduces this episode to us, notice a couple of things. First of all, there's reference to the hour of Jesus coming. And in John's gospel, this is imagery that I think throughout the gospel ultimately looks forward to what Christ will do on the cross and all that it entails. It's a term that it really anticipates the unique work that Jesus does on our behalf. And so as John is looking to the future, he has that in mind, even as he describes Jesus washing the disciples' feet. Notice also, John says Jesus is going to love them to the very end, or love them to the uttermost. And that really anticipates what Jesus is about to do, right? I mean, it's a great act of service, a great act of love for him to wash his disciples' feet. But ultimately, what I think John is doing with this language and the way he introduces this scene to us is he is linking this tangible act of service, right? This foot washing. He is linking this foot washing to what Jesus will ultimately do for us on the cross. And I think he's saying, look, you're about to see a very tangible act of Jesus' love for his followers. But as you see this tangible act, know that it's actually related to a deeper manifestation of the love of Jesus Christ that will be made known as Jesus hangs on a cross on your behalf. So it's like John looks at this and says, look, I want you to see how Jesus disrupts the life of the disciples. But even as you see this simple act of service, I want you to see that it's actually connected to something deeper. It's just not one guy serving other people. This is connected. It's an outgrowth. It's a manifestation of a deeper love that will ultimately be fully known only as Jesus hangs on the cross on your behalf. So, you know, John just kind of has both of these things in view, the cross and this act of service, as he begins to tell this story. And then, of course, John moves into the details of the evening, and you can read them as you kind of work through the story, but, you know, there is this moment in the course of this meal where Jesus gets up and he takes off his outer garments, puts on a towel, he takes a basin of water. And one by one, he begins going around the group, washing their feet. Now, as you may know, this would have typically been done by a servant. It was an act of hospitality given to one's guest from the host. Except in this case, it's not a servant who does it. Right? It's Jesus himself. I mean, Jesus is the one who now goes throughout the room washing the feet of each of his disciples. Now, this may just seem weird to you because we're not accustomed to this kind of action, right? That just seems like a weird thing to do. But you've got to understand, in this context, this was a socially and powerfully disruptive moment. Because understand that, you know, there are just certain social conventions, social norms about how people interact. Those are present in every culture. And in this cultural moment, you just didn't do what Jesus did. People of higher social status did not wash the feet of those of lower social status. In fact, in Jewish context, there were some rabbis who said a Jew should never do this at all. This should be reserved for a Gentile slave and only a Gentile slave because it was so menial and demeaning. And so in the midst of all their assumptions, right, about how things work and how people are to interact, Jesus gets up and he just disrupts all of that. And one by one, he goes around washing his disciples' feet. I can't help but wonder if initially there wasn't a certain awkward silence in the room. I mean, have you ever been in those social situations where someone breaks the social norm? Right? Maybe it's a family reunion and one of your kids asks a question that you're not supposed to ask to another relative. Or, you know, one of those situations where it's all of a sudden somebody's doing something that we know you're not supposed to do in public. And it's just awkward. I remember a few years ago when our kids were much younger, we were at a skate park. I had them at a skate park. They had a wonderful time on rollerblades and you know, scooters, and as I'm sitting there, other people are there with their kids, and there's a guy sitting on the other side of the park, and I presume he was there with his kids, and he's an amputee. One of his legs was amputated right below the knee, and so he's wearing a prosthetic, and it includes a long metal rod, and obviously a foot, and an athletic shoe on the other end, and he's sitting there. And I'm watching from the other side of the skate park as one of my kids walks up to him, and they have some kind of brief conversation. And then in utter horror, as a dad, I watch, and my son reaches out, and he grabs that metal rod. He's just going up and down, he was just absolutely mesmerized, right? And you know, this guy was gracious, and I'm sure he said it was okay, but, you know, I'm the dad sitting across the skate park going, no! Right? You're not supposed to do that. It's an awkward social moment because someone has broken the social norms. Well, that had to be how the disciples, the teacher just didn't get up and wash the feet of his disciples. You just don't do that. But here's Jesus doing it. Of course, it seems like it's Peter, right, that breaks the awkward silence. Peter, the guy who has the wonderful ability to say what other people are thinking but unwilling to say. What does he say? No. You're not going to wash my feet. You're not going to do it. And it's like he looks at Jesus and says, look, you're breaking the status quo. Don't do that. They had certain assumptions about how life works and how we were to relate to one another and how teachers related to students. And Jesus was overturning all of that. But when you think about it, that's what Jesus does, isn't it? That's what the good news of Christ does. It disrupts the status quo. You see, in our own way, we're kind of like the disciples. We have an understanding about how life works. And for each of us, there are certain things we believe will bring us success and happiness and fulfillment. And we have those categories in our lives, and there are different ways we try to fulfill them and keep them full. And there's a real sense yet when we truly engage Jesus, when we truly start that relationship and begin to pursue that relationship, he starts to disrupt that and shake up our categories. And he confronts us with the reality of a different approach to life. Now just think about these disciples for a moment, right? They had been with him. They had seen him do these amazing miracles. He could control nature. He could heal the sick. He could cast out demons. This amazingly powerful individual whom they admired so much. But now he is kneeling at their feet, washing their feet. Just going over the top and the bottom and, you know, washing their feet. That had to be an awkward moment, don't you think? I mean, after all, you know, many of these guys, they'd spent their lives outdoors working, and I'm sure their feet told the story. There were battle scars and knots and calluses. And it's one thing for a slave to see that. It's another thing for the master himself to see that. Yet here he was right in front of them kneeling, washing their feet. And I'm sure you felt awkward. Maybe you felt exposed in ways you'd never been before because teachers just don't do that. But you see, that's what Jesus does. When we engage him, he does expose us. He exposes our brokenness. He exposes our sin. He exposes our insecurity. But even as that happens, he also confronts us with his love. Because however awkward and surprising and maybe, you know, uncomfortable that moment had to be for those disciples, it was also the moment where, in a new and deeper way, they were understanding the reality of his love. They were understanding that he would go to no limits to bring them into relationship with himself. And this act anticipates what he ultimately does to manifest that love by dying on the cross. He was telling them, here I am to serve you, to restore you, to cleanse you, and ultimately to give my life for you. And if you are here this morning and you're not really quite sure what you think about Christianity, maybe you've just come to church from time to time, whatever brings you here, we're glad you're here. But understand, this is Jesus' invitation to you. He will disrupt your life. He invites you into a relationship that will expose you in the reality of your need for him, yet in doing so, you also encounter the reality of his love and forgiveness, which only he can give. So this is a disruptive moment. I mean, a really disruptive moment for the disciples. But as the scene unfolds, notice it's not simply a disruptive moment. It's also a teaching moment. I can't help but wonder if he finally gets around the room and there's just maybe a hush of silence, right? Still a little bit of a sense of shock, maybe a sense of relief that he's done. And in the quietness of that moment, Jesus begins to teach. He doesn't just let the moment hang there as an entity in itself, because this isn't simply a disruptive moment in the life of the disciples. It is also a teaching moment. And in the midst of that teaching moment, he says, I am giving you an example to follow. Even, right? I've shown you my love, now I want you to love one another. I have shown you my love, now I want you to love other people. And then he states this more directly later in the chapter, right? We get to verses 34 and 35 of chapter 13. Here's what we read. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. So this amazingly disruptive moment now builds to a teaching moment where the disciples are challenged that the love you are experiencing for me should now be at work in your relationships with others, particularly your relationships with other followers of Christ. Now, as you look at this, just notice a couple of things. First of all, notice the idea of new. Right? Jesus says, a new command I give you. Now, I think this is a point where it's easy to kind of scratch your head and go, wait a minute. Haven't we been told to love before? Right? This is a place I think it's natural for us to want to push back on Jesus to say, you know what, this isn't new at all. I've read the Old Testament. The Old Testament talks about loving your neighbor. That's very clear. Any Jew would have known this. This isn't a new commandment at all. In fact, it's interesting, later in the New Testament, we read the letters of John, right? This is the Gospel of John, but there are also several letters that he's written to early churches. And I think John feels this tension of, is it old or is it a new commandment? Because notice what we read in 1 John, one of the letters John writes, 1 John chapter 2. Dear friends, I am not writing you a new command, but an old one. Okay, it's an old command. Yet, I am writing you a new command. Whoa, 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 you just said it was an old command. Yet I am writing you a new command. Its truth is seen in him and in you because the darkness is passing and the true light is already shining. You feel the tension there a little bit? Come on, John, fess up. Is this old or is it new? Well, I think on the one hand, he's arguing, of course, this is in some sense an old commandment. Right? We read it through the pages of Scripture. We've known about this century after century. We were to love others. We're to love others. We're to love others. But here's why it's new. It's new because now it flows out of a relationship with Jesus. It's new because Jesus has ultimately given us the example of what it looks like. Furthermore, it's new because now that you are in relationship with him, you can now actually be empowered to love others this way. Because this commandment is linked to this new thing that God is doing through the work of Jesus Christ. Through Christ's work, God's rescue plan is now underway, and with that and your new relationship with him comes new ways to relate to other people. That's why John says, look, this is part of the true light that is already shining. So Jesus is telling his disciples, look, in light of what I'm doing in your behalf, I'm loving you in a new way. I'm bringing you into relationship with me. And now you are going to be able to love others in a new way as well. In fact, I think Jesus' expectation, which is very clear in John 13, is that our new relationship with him is creating new relationships with others. Right? As I have loved you, you are to love one another. And the one another there really refers to other believers. In other words, as you engage me, as you become a part of what I am doing, you become a part of a community of people who are also on this journey of following me. And it's in those relationships that we began to live out this love that Jesus describes. And then it flows into other relationships as well. But the expectation here is to be brought into relationship with Christ, is to be brought into relationships with others. This is why, let me just give you a heads up. Let me tell you where we're going in the series. As we've been talking about living with Jesus. We're now talking about loving like Jesus. We're going to be talking about, you know, living that out in your sphere of influence, leading others to do the same. But as we conclude this series, I'm going to ask you to take a step. And for some of you, it's going to be a pretty bold and dangerous step. And the step is to become part of a group where we're seeking to live out this way of life. You see, Jesus expects us to be in relationship here, right? You're going to do this and love one another. That's the expectation. We can't do that in a large church like this. You just don't have the relational capacity to be in relationship with everyone in this room. But you can be in smaller settings. And we want to give you the opportunity to do that and seek to build this DNA into the lives of our groups. And this is part of the journey of following Jesus. So even now, I want you to start thinking about that. I know it's a bold step for some of us because we're only accustomed to coming to church on Sundays or, you know, keeping our distance and relationships with other people. But it's actually part of doing life together and this way of life that we're unpacking over the course of these weeks. So I'm going to invite you to take that step in a couple of weeks. So here's what Jesus is saying. He says, look, I have brought you into relationship. And what I am doing in your life is to overflow into the lives of other people. Now, I realize in saying that, some of you are going, okay, this is nothing new. I mean, I've heard this forever and ever, right? Jesus loves us, we're to love other people. Jesus loves us, we're to love other people. We know that. And I think for many of us, this is something it's easy to verbalize. We can explain it. We know it theologically. We know Jesus' command. But the truth is, at least for some of us, I'm not sure it's transformational in our lives. For some of us, this is, you know, it's one of those theological truths we kind of compartmentalize in part of our brain, but it really doesn't have an impact on how we live in an everyday reality. And if that's the case, if that is the case for you, I think there's an underlying principle you need to be aware of. There really is an underlying principle that flows out of what Jesus is saying in John chapter 13. It's an underlying principle that is actually at work in your life right now. And if you don't understand this principle, it can help explain why there is this disconnect between Jesus' words in this text and how you are actually approaching life on an everyday basis. So with that in mind, here's the principle. The principle is simply this. How I receive God's love will shape how I love others. Simple principle, but I think it flows out of this text. Remember, Jesus said, as I have loved you, you are to love others. As I have loved you, you are to love others. And so the underlying principle is this. How I receive his love will shape how I love other people. So, with that in mind, let me just give you a couple of examples. Maybe the truth is I have a somewhat shallow understanding of God's love. Right? I mean, I'm a Christian. I've started this journey with Christ, but I'm not really I'm not really paying attention to my relationship with God. You know, I come to church periodically, but I basically do my own thing. And so the truth is, at some level, I have a shallow understanding of God's love. Can I suggest to you that over time, that shallowness of relating to God and understanding his love is going to work its way out in your relationships? And ultimately, when I kind of have a shallow understanding and connection to God and his love and what he seeks to do in my life, I think that will, over time, produce a shallow ability to truly love other people. So, for instance, it won't be surprising then if, as it turns out, I'm a person who really is only willing to invest in people that are easy to like, people exactly like me, people I can get along with so well that it doesn't take a lot of effort. And if this is the case, if I kind of have a shallow understanding of God's love that kind of affects my relationships with others, I think it won't be surprising if I'm a person who is easily disappointed with others, easily frustrated with other people. If I'm a person who is constantly complaining about other people, if I'm a person really who has no margin for people in significant ways. And I can say, well, that's just my personality or it's just my stage of life. But the truth is, what's going on here is how I'm relating to other people, how I am loving people is being shaped by how I receive his love. And if this is shallow on this side, at some point it's going to become shallow on the other side. Another example. Maybe part of your church background includes church or churches that you would now describe as, you know, they were pretty legalistic. You know, it's a church that, they had all these behavioral expectations, and man, you knew you couldn't step out of line, and if you ever stepped out of line, you didn't want anybody to know it because you knew you would hear about it. And maybe even looking back, you would say, I don't think that church really grabbed hold of the love of God. Well, I think that's true, but here's the deal. I think what was happening was this. In that church context, they had a certain perception of what the love of God looked like. And it's not surprising sometimes to feel like you're in a church context where you know, God's love seems to be performance-based. It seems to be achievement-based. It seems to be transactional, right? We do this for God, and he does this for us. And not surprisingly, then, if that's the way we understand God, you know, in a local church, it's going to play itself out in how we relate to one another. So for some of you, I'd say your church background, more than anything, shows you how certain people and how a certain church culture was understanding and processing the love of God. Because once again, Jesus says, right, as I have loved you, you are to love others. Which means, underlying that, how I receive his love is going to shape how I love other people. And you've got to be aware of this because this principle, I believe, is at work in your life and will play itself out in your life whether you realize it or not. How you relate to God, how you understand his love is going to shape and influence how you relate to others and how you love them. For instance, for those of us who are parents, let me just challenge you. How you understand God's love, how you relate to God's love, is over time playing it out in how you parent your child or your children. At times I'm confronted by this in my own life. I know, frankly, how easy it is to get focused on, well, how are you doing with your grades? Make sure the report's done or you're developing good study skills and da-da-da-da. Be responsible. And all of those are good and important things, yet if I'm not careful, and I've realized this over time, sometimes I have brought to my kids expectations that don't need to be there. And in my worst moments, I've tried to live my life through my kids and what they're doing. So as they've gotten older, I've had to understand some of my dreams need to die, right? Because they're not the dreams God has for my kids. They're my dreams. They're not dreams that really reflect how he has created them to be. But you know, the only thing that frees me from those dreams, the only thing that really moves me past those unhealthy expectations is the freedom that comes from living in God's love. Because when, you know, as I understand that relationship that I have with him and how he has initiated that and what he is doing in the context of that and the freedom that comes from that, it enables me to engage my kids in more positive ways. So how I receive his love will shape how I love others. Jesus says, as I have loved you, so I want you to love other people. Now, in challenging you to see that, I think we also need to understand this. For this command to be at work within our lives, we need to be aware that certain things can get in the way. I mean, there are certain things that get in the way of what Jesus is talking about here. Certain things that get in the way of me living in response to him, living in this relationship in a way that moves me to respond differently to other people. And let me just briefly just highlight for you just a couple of things that I think can get in the way of living out what Jesus describes here. First of all, busyness. I think busyness. Right over the last couple of weeks, we've talked about living with Jesus, making room in our lives for God and, you know, and building practices and rhythms into our lives that develop and allow God to be at work. And I'm sure some of you said, well, that sounds great, but I don't have time. I'm just too busy. And that's understandable. I mean, we live, many of us, at a very frantic pace. And sometimes in the midst of our responsibilities and all these good things in our lives, it just seems like, you know, God, that just doesn't seem to be that important, or I don't have room for it. It's a great idea, but it gets pressed out in the rush of doing other things. And yet, even in thinking about that, I'm reminded of something the Apostle Paul says in the book of Ephesians. And the latter part of Ephesians, really beginning in chapter 4, Paul talks about living in healthy ways in terms of our roles and responsibilities, relating to other people. It's really a description of what it looks like to in healthy and positive ways be in relationship with others. But right before he has that lengthy discussion, right at the end of chapter 3, there's a prayer. And the prayer is all about God's love, but it's not I'm praying that you love God better. It's I'm praying that you know more of God's love. Such a counterintuitive prayer. We thought, well, we're supposed to love God, love God, love God. We need to do it better and better and better. Now, that's true, but Paul's prayer is that you might know more of the love of God. And I think the underlying logic is this. Paul says, look, I'm about to talk to you about how to relate to other people in marriage and the workplace and conversation. And the only way to do this well, the only way to truly love other people well and to be healthy in relationships is to also be in healthy relationship with God and to live in light of his love. So for some of us, it's just busyness that gets in the way of developing a relationship with him that allows us then to see his work in our lives overflow and move into our relationships to others. Another thing that can get in the way is sin. I mean, the truth is, you may be here and there's a sense in which you want to keep a certain distance in your relationship with God because there's certain patterns in your life, certain behaviors, addictions, pornography, whatever. There's certain things in your life that you know are not healthy, but you just don't want to deal with it. You're not sure you can deal with it. You're not sure there can be victory. And so somehow there's some, you know, dimension of sin that's now taken root in your life in such a way that it is hampering your relationship with God, hampering your ability to live in response of his love. And whether you realize it or not, it is therefore also affecting your relationships with other people. So busyness, sin. Thirdly, I would say unexamined emotions. And I've included things like fear, anger, bitterness, anxiety. For some of us, these are deep parts of who we are for different reasons, and we've never gotten to the point of really wrestling with, okay, God, where's this coming from? Where's this fear coming from? And why is it at work in my life? We've just kind of gotten accustomed to it. And as a result, certain things can take root in our life emotionally that begin in different ways to tarnish or diminish our relationship with God and once again affect how we are engaging other people. Finally, I think another thing that can get in the way are the negative scripts handed down to us. What do you mean by that? Well, here's what I mean. Each of us, over the course of our lives, we have different things, different events, different relationships that have shaped us, that have influenced us. And through the course of our lives and these different relationships and different strategic moments in our lives, we've received certain messages. And some of us just take those on, and they become a part of who we are without evaluating or kind of at times confronting those scripts that have been given to us. So for instance, maybe you grew up in a family that really valued peacekeeping above all else. You know, we've got to keep the peace. And you grew up in a situation where we never really dealt with hard stuff. And so now in your relationships, that you've just absorbed that. That's a script you play off of. And in your family, in your marriage, in your relationships, you're never really willing to have hard conversations. You're never really willing to go there. And what it has done, whether you realize it or not, it's now shaping, perhaps at times in very negative ways, your relationships with other people. I mean, can you really truly love other people and be for them when there are things that you're not willing to talk about in the context of those relationships? And the truth is, this is a place in your life where the gospel needs to break through and God's love needs to start working at you so that as you engage him and allow his work to be, you know, present in your life, you can engage those situations differently. But others of us are stuck because we're playing off an old script, an unhealthy script, and we've never really allowed the love of God to break through that. So this is the invitation Jesus gives. He says, look, I'm here to disrupt your life with who I am and what I'm doing. But in doing that, as you walk with me, as you live with me, I also want to be at work in your life in such a way that it now flows in positive ways into your relationships here at the church, into your relationships in your family, if you're part of a family, in your relationships in the marketplace, in the community. As I have loved you, love one another. We're going to come to a time of communion momentarily, and I'll come back to introduce that. But even now, I want to kind of leave you with this question, and that's the question I'm going to come back to in a moment. And the question is simply this: what aspect of your life does the gospel need to disrupt? What aspect of your life does the gospel need to disrupt? I'll unpack that a little more in a moment, but as we continue now, we're going to have a time of offering, and as our band comes up, I'm going to invite you to join me in prayer. Would you do that? Let's pray together. Gracious God, this morning, it's a familiar passage to many of us. Jesus washes his disciples' feet. Jesus tells us, love others as I have loved you. Those words, I confess, sometimes they're so familiar, they just hit us in a very flat way. And yet, God, I pray that even this morning we've been able to step into that scene just a little bit and feel how disruptive it can be. Because in reality, that's what Jesus does. He comes into our lives, and as we live with him, as we start this relationship with him, he disrupts where we're at. But he does so that in a new way, we can experience life and forgiveness. But it never stops there, because in moving into our lives, he now says, look, this is to shape how you engage other people. So Father, I pray we'd be open to that. And I pray even this morning that if there's some area of our lives where you need to break through, that this could be a disruptive moment. In Jesus' name.